Welcome to BookendsBookClub.net, a service of the Team Approach. Here, we dialogue with featured authors about their books related to business management and team cultivation, as well as personal and organizational development. Our website contains study guides for many of the books discussed and related tools to help your organization excel. Let's listen in as our host Susan Stamm engages today's guest author.
I'm Susan Stamm, your host for today's interview. Today, we will visit with Julie Straw, the co-author of The Work of Leaders, How Vision, Alignment, and Execution Will Change the Way You Lead. Julie is also the author of The Four-Dimensional Manager. To access today's podcast or any of our previous interviews, including Julie's previous interviews featuring The Four-Dimensional Manager, you can visit bookendsbookclub.net. At the end of today's interview, I will tell you how you can get a complimentary copy of today's featured book, Compliments of the Team Approach. Welcome back to Bookends, Julie Straw.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to visit with you again. I enjoyed reading about the extensive process, Julie, that you and your team of co-authors completed to create this book and the Vision Alignment Execution Model. Tell us a little bit about the literature search. How did your team actually curate the books that you ended up reading as a group? And was there one specific golden nugget from your readings that really stayed with you from this reading immersion process you went through?
Well, it was actually a process that began almost 6 years ago. So we really spent about a year reading just about everything we could get our hands on. And I'll be honest, I'm glad there were four authors. We didn't all read the same thing, but someone would say, oh, I read this, and we'd get together and we'd talk about it. And what was interesting about that process is sort of trying to make sense out of all of it, because sometimes what one leadership guru would say would totally contradict what another leadership guru would say, or sometimes one author would take a deep dive into just one part of leadership. So we had to try to figure out how to make sense out of all of that. And I'd say, you know, we read things that were classic, like Peter Drucker, Warren Bennis. We read things that were a little bit more contemporary, Marcus Buckingham, Seth Godin. We tried to make sure we were reading a wide range of things, things that thrived in the nonprofit sector, like Frances Hesselbein, Gloria Duffy. And we read things from leaders who've really done well in the corporate world, like Harry Kramer. But the one book that I kept coming back to was just a really simple book. It's Tribes by Seth Godin. And it's actually, I don't know if I like it because it's a really short book, but one of the things that he does early in his book is he really talks about the difference between leadership and management. And we really felt like we really needed to draw a distinction between the two, because that's where a lot of learners and readers get hung up. They get hung up on trying to define what's the difference between leadership and management. And quite honestly, if you look at a thesaurus will say that the best synonym for leadership is management. So it's no wonder it's confusing. But in his book, Tribe, Seth Godin says that management is about manipulating resources to get a job done, and leadership is about creating change that you believe in. So we really stepped back and used that and said, okay, in this management relationship, it is a one-to-one relationship. A manager is managing a person, and how I manage John might be different than how I manage Heather. So it's a one-to-one relationship, whereas leadership is a one-to-many relationship. As a leader, your job is to lead a group of people. They are following you. So that really helped us differentiate leadership from management.
That's great, and I'm sure that that was a very terrific year to have the chance to just really delve into all of that information. In the book, Julie, you talk about something that you call Myth of the Mountaintop. Tell us about this. How did it develop, and what is its impact on organizations?
Well, I think the myth of the mountaintop is when we talk about leaders, we think about these, you know, fantastic leaders like Steve Jobs or, you know, Juliet Gordon Lowe, who formed the Girl Scouts. You think about these leaders who just did something. Martin Luther King's, I have a dream. That's mm-hmm. a leader. And unfortunately, I think we sort of get that image in our mind that only that type of person can be defined as a leader. So the myth of the mountaintop is really about this idea that there's some robed mystic who sits high on the mountaintop, or in the corporate world, they sit in the C-suite, and they, you know, have an idea, and the vision appears, and then they come out into the, come down from the mountain, or come into the company meeting, and they share their vision, and that's it, job done. And we really wanted to dispel that, that first of all, it's not just that group of people who are leaders, that leaders exist at every level in the organization. So every level, I mean, the team leader at the wash and lube, the production manager at a cereal plant, the radiology supervisor at a regional hospital, those people are all leaders, and they have to lead, and we wouldn't think about them as the mountaintop visionary.
Yeah. And I once heard a local professor from one of the prestigious schools here in our area of Pennsylvania make the comment that if the only thing a leader ever does is create a vision, perhaps mm-hmm. that's enough. And it really bothered me. I mean, I wasn't quite sure why. And after reading your book, of course, you know, it's one thing just to have a vision, but if there's not alignment and execution, you know, you really haven't taken that far enough. Your team also did a correlation study on leaders and vision. Tell us about what you learned.
Yeah, that was an interesting study. We have access to a lot of people in an online format who take our assessment, so we can gather a lot of data, quite honestly. And in one study, we asked almost 4,000 people to rate a specific leader in their organization. And what we were really wondering is, does that person create a strong vision for the group's future? And at the same time, we're able to actually correlate those responses, which basically means we can also measure how well regarded that person was as a leader. So we were able to look at people who said, hey, this person is a fantastic leader, and this is what I have to say about whether they create a strong vision for the group or not. Or we looked at people who were, you know, middle-rated leaders or even poorly rated leaders. So here's what's interesting in that data. We looked at the best rated leaders and whether they create a strong vision for their group's future, and 87% of people who rated leaders as best rated leaders, these are the people that really lead well, said that, yes, this person creates a strong vision for the future. And then if you look at our middle rated leaders, only 32% of those leaders create a strong vision, and bumping down to our worst rated leaders, the people that people don't really want to follow, so I don't know if they're really not leaders, but only 10% of those people were reported as actually creating a strong vision for the group's future. So that tells us that when somebody says, yep, that person is a fantastic leader, chances are they are very good at figuring out what the vision is for the group's future. And that was really striking to us.
Yeah, I found that a really, really interesting study. You also opened the book, the first part of the book, describing the model vision with a stinging statement. You say that curiosity is one of the first casualties of responsibility. I agree.
Oh.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, if you think about your life in general, as human beings, we are naturally pretty curious. So, you know, as children are very curious, they ask about things, they're inquisitive, they're imaginative, and yet when we walk into work on Monday morning, we tend to park that curiosity, we tend to park our imaginations, because we're basically almost taught and encouraged to just, you know, do what you're asked to do, nothing more. And that aspect of being part of a organization really kills curiosity. It really kills the inquisitive nature of us. So it's that sense of exploration, and people aren't given permission or encouraged to take that exploration and to kind of think outside the box. And I see that all over organizations across all markets, that it just really kills the curiosity. You come in, you do your job, you do what you're asked, nothing more. And
yeah,
that's it.
I think it is sad, and I think this really ties into, you know, those really huge numbers that we see on the cost of lack of employee engagement. Because really, you know, when people have parked that curiosity, that spirit of innovation, how can we solve this problem in a new way? How can we serve the customer in bigger ways? I think we're really talking about the same kinds of things there. And, of course, we know that those numbers are huge and enormous. So this is really an important point that you're making in the book, I think, Julie.
Yeah, so absolutely.
You say 65% of leaders admit that they struggle with remaining open. Can you explain why this is an important driver for this stage of the process, of course, vision, and, you know, some of the strategies that you share to help people be more effective in this area?
Yeah, I think that when it comes to being a leader, there's a couple things going on. One is some leaders have this sense of, I'm the leader. I should know what to do. I should declare what we're going to do, and then I should lead people to that. And the reality is when you are crafting a vision, you have to have this sense of remaining open to ideas that are outside of what you're currently thinking about, to ideas that come from perhaps different industries, different markets. And to be a really effective leader when it comes to crafting a vision, you have to stay open. You can't lock down too early. And a lot of leaders do lock down too early. And psychologists even actually have a name for this. They measure something called need for closure. It even has an acronym, NFC. And this is really defined as a desire for a quick, firm answer, any answer to a question. So this need for closure is about getting rid of uncertainty. It's about getting rid of the ambiguity of not knowing. And a lot of leaders rush to that because it gives them a better sense. So this remaining open is uncomfortable. A lot of people have a really hard time with it. And yet, when you're crafting a vision, it's really important that you remain open. You have to just pull back and resist that temptation to run with the first idea and really just play around with it, and don't reject ideas that just because you're not sure how it might get implemented. Keep those on the board. So it's that uncertainty, which is, for many of us, quite uncomfortable. But that's what leaders need to do when they're crafting a vision, is stay open.
Yeah. I found the contextual nature of this model you're talking about right now, remaining open, as it relates to crafting a vision. And yet, you know, we certainly know that there's times where it's really important for leaders to be able to get closure. And, you know, then we think how the pace of business and how much leaders have on their plate actually tie into this need to, okay, let's just, you know, get this done, put a check in the checkbox, move on.
Yeah.
And a vision is much more than just a task that's on your plate.
It is, and that process takes time, and you are absolutely right. In today's world, we often don't allow the time to just wander around and explore ideas and remain open. We don't give it time. We're in so much of a hurry that we want to lock down. We hear a good idea, and we say, yep, that's it, let's go.
So another important driver of vision, this first part of the model, is boldness. And you share an interesting illustration of how hard it is to be bold in a story that you talk about, some research that was involving a group of students. Tell us a little bit about this and a few of your tips for practicing boldness.
Absolutely. That was actually Dr. Mark Scullard, one of our co-authors, he teaches part-time at the University of Minnesota. And he likes to perform a little experiment with his students each semester. And it went like this. He basically would ask the students to guess how much time elapsed between hearing the words start and stop. And the first time they would do it, he'd ask the students to write down their guesses on a piece of paper and then hand them in, and he would tally them on the board. And in the second trial, the students actually reported their answers aloud, one right after the other. And what Dr. Scholar discovered was there was a big difference between the two experiments. When the students guessed aloud, there was a lot less variability. So meaning, let's say we said start and we said stop, and the first student said, oh, that was 14 seconds. Right down the line, the second student might say 13 seconds, 14 seconds, 15 seconds, 14 seconds, 12 seconds. It never varied. Even if a particular student might have thought, well, I thought that was more like 20 seconds, they wouldn't say it. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't say it because we have, as human beings, we have a strong desire to conform. And when students recorded their answers on a piece of paper and then handed them in, there were always outliers. There were always people that were way above or way below in terms of guessing how much time had elapsed. So what Mark discovered was in a group setting, we don't want to look stupid. It's sort of built into our DNA to not look stupid. So we tend to conform, and that narrows our thinking. So when we talk about being bold, we're talking about having the guts, having the confidence to speak your mind, even if it's not what everyone else is saying. Because sometimes out of that comes a really good idea, or sometimes we discover something that we hadn't thought about. So instead of everyone conforming and going, yep, yep, that, oh, that's a good idea, let's go with that, it's like, you know what, no, I have another idea, and it's totally off the wall, but I'm going to share it because I'm a bold thinker, and we've created a culture where we appreciate bold thinking and we encourage people to say what they think. That's being bold.
When I was reading this, one of the thoughts that came to my mind is some of the research that came out about a year or two ago on brainstorming, you know, where people were sort of saying, no, you know, this really doesn't work when you take a group of people in a public kind of environment the way we've always done it. And it was really interesting how his research supported and, you know, techniques such as nominal group technique or something like that that's a little bit more private. You can still pull a group of people together, but give them the chance to do it more private brainstorming that you pull together as a group. It was pretty interesting, the parallel between that and how it reinforced.
Sometimes in brainstorming we have these ground rules and we apply them when we're brainstorming. Like, no idea is a bad idea. No, yeah, but. So we don't want people to say, yeah, but we did that before. And when we're in a formal brainstorming session and we declare those rules, people tend to abide by them. And what we're saying, when you're crafting a vision, you sort of have to apply those brainstorming rules. No idea is a bad idea. Don't judge. Don't say no. No, don't say yeah, but, and give 10 reasons why something won't work. Remaining open and being bold in your thinking is really part of that.
Well, Julie, I do a good deal of supervisory training in the work that I do, and I found the research that you share regarding pay to be really interesting. It was kind of a new way of looking at a discussion that I have with supervisors regularly. Tell us about this and how you how what you learn ties to the second dimension in the model, which, of course, is alignment.
So, I think anytime you ask anybody what's important to their job, I mean, we work so that we can support our families and have the things that we choose to have in our lives. So pay would be expected to be important, and in fact it is. We did a survey, and the largest role in determining a person's happiness at work, when we asked the question, what would increase your job satisfaction, better pay by far surpassed every other factor. But here's where you can actually kind of dissect the study. So we, on the sort of the back end, we asked questions about how happy people were in their jobs, and then we could correlate that with current job satisfaction. So we're looking at people who say, yes, I like my job. I love what I'm doing. And then we ask them what factors would increase your job satisfaction. And when we did that, pay was actually more than halfway down the list. So people think pay is going to make them more happy, but really it ends up being by far less important. The factor that had the highest correlation with job satisfaction was a chance to have my opinions heard and considered. People want to be listened to. They want to feel like they can contribute. They can share their ideas. And that's really an important part of alignment. So even if we don't take your idea, the fact that it was heard is really important for people to get on board.
Yeah, it seems like such a simple thing, and it is not. It's huge.
Yeah. But again, I think as leaders, we say, okay, we've got our idea, let's run with this, and we turn into telling mode. And even once you have the idea, this is our vision, this is where we're going, in order to get people aligned with that vision, you have to allow them the opportunity to ask questions, to share their thoughts, to have a dialogue so that you're exchanging perspectives. Even if this is where you're going to go as a leader, you have to get people on board. You have to get them aligned. And having that dialogue and listening to people is a really important part of that process. Dialogue is a two-way street. Gaia means two. And it doesn't mean one person talks and one person listens. It means that two people have a conversation, and they're both asking questions, and they're both listening to one another. So that's where leaders have to really make sure that they're listening to the people who are following them, or they're not going to be aligned with them. They're not going to be on the same page.
So true. So true. So to be successful at dialogue, what we were just talking about, we must be receptive. And, of course, in these fast-paced business environments that we already talked about a little earlier, you know, this is really challenging to do. So what, you know, do you have a couple of tips, you know, to get people to, you know, perhaps slow down and really do this effectively?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think one of the unspoken methods of dialogue is really your body language. So as a leader, you know, kind of slow down and just be aware of your tone of voice rather than kind of using a tone that says my way or the highway. Slow things down. Open up. Ask questions. Get feedback. Watch your body language. Sometimes leaders tend to, this is my way or the highway, and they kind of bear down, and their body says that. And yet we're saying, you know, really listen to people. And then when you do listen to people, make sure that your body isn't being skeptical, that your body language isn't being disapproving. So work on that. And, you know, for some leaders, you might have to practice that in front of the mirror, because sometimes our body language doesn't convey what we're trying to convey, even though we think it is. So pay attention to your body language. And then secondly, I talked a little bit earlier about this, what I call yeah buts. A lot of times we'll listen to somebody and we say, yeah, but, and you're really not saying yeah at all. You're totally disagreeing with their idea. So I would encourage leaders to not counter what someone has said. Mm-hmm. And instead really say, things like, tell me more about that. Or, you know, tell me why you're thinking that. That opens the door for them to kind of say more about that, and you're being much more of an empathic listener. Your emotion is aligning with it. So those are really two things that I would absolutely do. And then just looking for signs for people telling you what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. So if you're really just trying to call out people that agree with you and you're sort of ignoring the people that are not on board, that's not a good strategy. You really need to focus on the people who are not on board, find out why they're not on board, get them enough information so that they want to be working with you. They want to be following you.
Yeah, and it's so often, I think, is the error in not doing that. It appears to be the easy way out. And in the long run, you're killing alignment and you're not going to get the result that you're looking for. So it's really critical to call those folks out and really engage them in the process on the front end. I really appreciate that.
Know, Susan, alignment is the one thing that is a real head nodder for leaders. Of course you have to have people aligned. But when it comes to actually getting alignment, people have not had formal training on it. They don't understand what they can be doing to create that alignment. So they realize that it's important, but they expect it just to happen. And it can't just happen. It's hard work. Yeah. But I'm telling you, if you get people aligned, then you have things moving in the right direction. And as a leader, you can't possibly be with every single person every step of the way. People are making decisions on their own. They're doing their work. And if you want them to be making decisions that support your vision, they have to understand what the vision is and be aligned with that vision.
So true. Well, my favorite part of the model was actually execution, and this really surprised me. I didn't expect that that's what would come out of this for me. In fact, I found the idea for leaders to engage in this activity to be a challenging idea, just like we were just talking about alignment, but perhaps even more so here. But I really feel this is something that leaders need to hear and pay attention to. And you share in the book some wisdom from some of the thought leaders through the ages, going back as far as Newton all the way, you know, through to people, big names like Tom Peters, as you describe the first driver in this part of the model, and that driver is momentum. Tell us a little bit about some of the big ideas that support through these big, you know, well-known gurus out there that support the importance of this particular driver.
Yeah, it is. It's an area where a lot of leaders sort of say, okay, my work is done, and now I'm going to leave this up to the managers to get the work done. And that's actually why we were very deliberate about choosing the phrase championing execution. The leader has to champion execution. And you're absolutely right. Building momentum is very important in this aspect. So, and it is really well documented. So Tom Peters talked about in his book, which was written in the 1980s, but it's still very, very
timely.
Much out there. His book, In Search of Excellence, he really talked about the idea of bias for action, so getting things done. John Maxwell called momentum a leader's best friend. Ron Schramm wrote an entire book on execution, and an important part of that is getting things moving. So that momentum is really important. If you ever played sports, you know how important momentum is. You get momentum going. We use the story of a swimming pool, an above-ground swimming pool, a circular swimming pool, if you can imagine jumping in that pool and getting all the kids to walk in the same direction. You create a whirlpool, right?
Yeah.
And once you stop walking, the water keeps going. Now, as a kid, that's a lot of fun. You can float in it. You can try to walk against it. But the point is that once you get that momentum going, it's hard to stop.
Yeah.
So in an organization, for a leader to champion execution means you have to create that momentum. And it is hard to get going, but once you have momentum, that keeps going. That's where Newton comes in. Newton's first law, if you remember back to your physics class, is the law of inertia. And that's the idea that a body at rest tends to remain at rest, and a body in motion tends to stay in motion. Well, that's momentum. So think about it as a leader. If you can create momentum, then things will keep moving. And it's your responsibility as a leader to create momentum. You have to keep things moving so that there's a sense of urgency. So leaders can do this by establishing dates, not just the end date, like in 5 years, this is what we're going to do, but what are we going to do this month, this quarter, this year to keep things moving? What are our targets? How are we going to measure our stepping stones? And put those things in place and then celebrate the successes and redirect when you need to redirect, but keep that momentum going.
Yeah, those are great ways to build momentum, and I think a lot of leaders miss those opportunities because it just feels too tactical to them. And that's where I'd like to kind of take us as we bring this to a close today, Julie. I get the feeling, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I get the feeling that I will encounter a lot of leaders who will look at this execution part of the model and, you know, they'll have a little pushback and they'll say, you know, that's not a function of, you know, my role. I'm a leader. That's a function of management, not leadership. So I really appreciate it. And that's why I think that this was my favorite part of the book, because it was a little revolutionary, against perhaps traditional kinds of contemporary kind of thinking. But it was challenging and so right on. So enlighten us, when you go back to your research, what could you share with us about this? Why is this a function of leadership?
Well, remember, the thing that I liked about the Tribes book was that Seth Godin basically said there is a difference. But you are absolutely right. A lot of people get confused about what is leadership and what is management. So we actually dug in. One of our co-authors, Barry Davis, is a little bit of a historian. So he dug in and he said, where did this come from? And he actually traced the roots of thinking that managers manage tasks and leaders lead people all the way back to the 1900s. There was a managing director of a French mining company by the name of Henri Fiol, and he was delivering a speech at an international mining congress in Paris. Now, remember, this was the 1900s, so he really encouraged the audience to start giving the administrative function as much attention as the technical aspects of running their companies, and that's really kind of the dawn of management theory. So later, 1916, his work in this business administration was actually published, and they identified five functions of management: planning, organizing, commanding, coordinating, and controlling. So management became this really well-defined task. And when you look at execution, you think, well, that's what execution is all about. It's about planning and organizing and commanding and coordinating and controlling. And yet we're saying that, yes, those tasks need to be done, but as a leader, you have to stay engaged in this process and you have to champion that execution. So it's your job as a leader to create that momentum. It's your job as a leader to say, okay, we're going to implement this, we're going to roll it out, but we need structure here. We need to have a plan. We need to do some analysis of things, and I have to champion that. I may not do those tasks as a leader, but I have to create an environment in which people understand that this is important and it's contributing to our achieving our goals, is going to where we want to go. We're getting to our vision by doing these things. And people also need feedback, and the leader has to be part of that. The leader should be in there offering praise. The leader should be in there addressing problems. You can't just step back and say, okay, I'm done with that, and disengage. You, as a leader, have to stay engaged when it comes to championing execution.
I think this was, just so important part of the book that kind of brings everything all together. And, so often leaders complain that they don't really know what's going on out there. And I really think this is why, Julie, is that they've delegated this. And, in doing so, they don't have their hand on the pulse of the organization any longer.
Right. Yep. And this is their opportunity to stay engaged. Again, they're not doing every single task, but they're in the game. You don't see a coach leave the game in the fourth quarter.
Exactly.
And they're there encouraging and directing, and they're leading that team. Even if they're 20 points ahead, they don't leave the game at that point.
That's a great analogy. I love it. Well, Julie, we have only scratched the surface of your book and the model in our interview today, but we have run out of time. And as I mentioned, our firm, The Team Approach, has had your really firsthand opportunity to really see the power of this model in action through our work. And we would like to invite organizations to explore its potential for their leadership practice. And so I'm inviting interested leaders whose organizations are not already working with a Wiley Everything Disc partner to contact me for a complimentary copy of your book. People can reach out to me through bookendsbookclub.net, which of course is where the today's interview will reside, or our main website, which is simply teamapproach.com, and to get a free copy of The Work of Leaders for your organization. So once again, Julie, we want to thank you for being with us today, for being our guest, and for sharing your wisdom in this model, vision, alignment, and execution. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Well, Bookends is brought to you by The Team Approach. Our producer is John David Bowman, and I'm Susan Stamm. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.